Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. On February 17, 1864, a torpedo from a Confederate submarine called the H.L. Hunley blew a hole in the side of a Union ship called the USS Housatonic in Charleston Harbor, becoming the first combat submarine to sink a warship in history. But after the attack, the Hunley disappeared. It was finally found on the ocean floor in 1995 and raised from the depths in 2000. The Hunley was remarkably intact. The bodies of the 8 crewmen remained inside, and they left behind a mystery. Exactly how did they die? Rachel Lance may have solved that mystery. As a grad student at Duke, with expertise in explosions and the trauma they cause, Lance set out to learn whether the same blast that sank the Housatonic may have killed the Hunley's own crew. She's published the story of her research in a new book called In the Waves. It's both a serious work of scholarship and a fun look into history, mystery, and the joy of blowing stuff up. Here's our conversation. Rachel Lance, among other things, you're an expert in what happens when stuff blows up. So how did you first get interested in explosions?
Oh, well, I think that was something I was born with. But professionally speaking, it just occurred to me one day that this was a viable career choice as a scientist. And from there, nobody really stopped me. So I think once you get to pursue something that most people find is inherently fascinating as explosions, and then do that in a professional setting, then that seemed like an easy choice to me.
And what drew you in particular to the Hunley?
It actually started as what was supposed to be a little bit of a side project. I was at Duke and I was working in an injury biomechanics lab. I was already fully employed by the Navy and I was getting my PhD at the same time. And my advisor kind of just wandered into my office one day and asked me, what did I think about the Hunley? I, of course, had no idea what he was talking about at first, but after some frantic Googling, I agreed it looked like a really interesting project, and it kind of had all the hallmarks that we normally expect of a blast trauma. But of course, as scientists, you can't just declare you think you know the answer. You have to actually go get data. So from there, things spiraled wildly out of control.
And it's pretty clear that when you went to talk to the scientists who had already started working on the Hunley, and down in Charleston, they weren't exactly welcoming to you, right?
They weren't. I think some of that is understandable to a degree, and some of it was very frustrating. When you have a project that you've been working on passionately for a really long time, I think that there's a human natural tendency to kind of want to keep that project for yourself. But at the same time, in science, you really have to understand that each person tends to be very specialized. Like, I'm obviously very specialized into this very small field. And then the way that things move forward in general is you collaborate with other people. So you collaborate with other people who might know things that you don't, who might have experiences and backgrounds that you don't. So that was a little bit of a frustrating experience, but I'm really glad I decided to pursue it anyway. To me, this was a public artifact, right? So it's a public question.
I also wondered, you didn't really, you know, dwell on this in the book, but I also wondered two other things about that. One, whether any of that resistance to you had anything to do with you being a woman. And the other is whether it might have had something to do with you not being a born and bred Southerner.
Well, I think that question always kind of pops in your mind a little bit, but it's also something that really is hard to prove, right? In my career, I have had people very specifically say, I don't want to do this because you're a woman, or you can't do this because you're a woman. A lot of people are still shockingly comfortable saying that overtly. This wasn't one of those cases. So it's really, really difficult to tell. And at the end of the day, from my perspective, I don't necessarily need to know the exact reasons why someone treated me a certain way or why someone didn't want to do something, because the end result is still the same.
A lot of this book, you did a lot of historical research before you started even, you know, doing your experiments. And I think when the Hunley was first rescued, a lot of us were surprised there had been a submarine in the Civil War to begin with. We didn't know that history. But as you talk about in the book, there have been many attempts way before that to create something that we might think of as a submarine, right?
Yes. So the first recorded, documented submarine prototype was actually 1520. So it's a lot older than most people think. I actually didn't know there were submarines during the Civil War either at the very beginning, and I'm kind of a little bit of a submarine obsessive. So these are devices that just aren't really well known. And a lot of the reason for that is because they weren't considered like a gentlemanly or appropriate method of warfare. So the people that were building these, even during the Civil War, they were considered a little bit rogue. They were breaking the rules. Submarines were sometimes nicknamed infernal machines, which meant that they came literally from hell. Like, this is a hellish idea. These were not the norm of warfare, but they did exist for much longer than most people have known.
But the one hallmark of many of them, or most of them up through the Hunley, is that they didn't work very well. You know, in fact, the Hunley had killed many people before that night in 1864, right?
Yes. Actually, it was originally named the Fishboat. And it was renamed the Hunley after one of its inventors, Horace Hunley, died inside his own vessel. And the reason that happened was because he decided to kind of go joyriding one day. And he was either out of practice or uninformed. People have their own interpretations, but ended up plowing it down into the ocean floor and couldn't get it dislodged. So unfortunately, in that accident, all eight of the crew inside the vessel died. Before it went out on its final mission, two crews had already been in serious fatal accidents, at least. There are some records of more sinkings than that, but they're more debatable.
On that night in 1864, the Hunley actually succeeds. It sinks the Housatonic, but then the crew members don't make it back. And could you explain, you talk about this in the book, sort of what some of the prevailing theories have been over the years as to why the crew didn't survive?
Okay. So after it set off its explosion, February 17, 1864, it disappears. There's one crewman from the Housatonic who kind of says he catches a backward glance of it as he's running for his life. But after that, nobody really sees it again, at least until modern times. Immediately, one of the theories that they put forward was that they might have sunk it with gunfire. So they know that at least the captain of the Housatonic, as this Hunley was approaching, was standing on this horse block and firing at it with a rifle. And so he was saying, you know, maybe I hit it. Maybe I actually sank it. Because the North knew that it didn't return home fairly quickly. So that was one theory, and that one's called the lucky shot theory. That one was a lot more plausible before they found where the submarine was located. So if it had been found really close to the wreck of the Housatonic, that one would have made sense. But it was found pretty far away. And so you can kind of debunk that one just based on the fact that it would have had to drift for quite a while before it finally settled to the ocean floor. And then the other major theory was one of asphyxiation, which basically means that they sat inside their closed hull for whatever reason until they ran out of air and passed out. Now, the thing that's interesting about that is that the oxygen levels were not necessarily what would have determined their ability to stay inside there. So that was actually one of the first things that I studied, because that seems like a very plausible scenario, right? But anytime you're inside an enclosed space, you're also exhaling carbon dioxide. And while low oxygen may not always have very strong signs and symptoms, high carbon dioxide is extremely unpleasant. So those guys would have had panting for breath. They would have had high heart rates. They would have had massive migraines. I think 7% carbon dioxide, your breathing rate quintuples compared to sitting. So that was basically the level that I used for the cutoff. And I figured out that in that size gas volume, with a work rate that would have been appropriate for cranking, they would have had at least 10 minutes of warning time where they would have been experiencing that carbon dioxide problem before they would have had any risk of losing consciousness. Those were really the two main ones that had occurred. The third one was that the submarine had been damaged during the blast. But of course, once people actually found the physical submarine and they did the studies and looked at the sediment and the way the sediment had collected, they were able to determine that it was not, in fact, damaged during the explosion at all.
And one of the things, to go back to the suffocation theory, was that in that case, they probably would have struggled to get out. But when the bodies were found, it was as if they hadn't moved, right?
Exactly. So all eight of them were basically seated where they were during combat. There's some evidence that the first one at the first crank position might have been trying to crawl his way out a little bit, but nobody made any big panic motions. In the previous sinkings, you have these records of people who know they're dying, who know that they're running out of air. Horace Hundley was found in the conning tower with his hand trying to push the door open still when he died. But in the case of the final sinking, the captain of the vessel literally just slumped over on his chair. Like his bones are still in position, just in a sitting spot with absolutely no effort to get out. They didn't even unlock one of the conning tower hatches. And so carbon dioxide is not only physically uncomfortable, but in the psychiatric world, it's used to cause panic attacks. So if you have people who have otherwise been very stalwart and calm and steadfast, you can still induce a biological panic attack in many of them with carbon dioxide. So the idea that they just sort of sat there, all eight of them, and underwent this willingly is a little bit contrary to human nature.
So here's my dumb science question. I will probably ask other ones, but here's the first one. So
there are dumb science questions.
As you describe in great detail in the book, these guys were just really crammed together in this submarine, shoulder to shoulder, sideways, turning these hand cranks. They barely had any room to move or sit or anything. And of course, because the vessel was so small, they only had a limited amount of oxygen. Why didn't they just make the thing bigger?
Great question. I was trying to really convey the claustrophobia of this thing, so I'm glad that came across a little bit. But basically, this is the South during the Civil War, right? They're outmanned, they're outgunned. They don't have a lot of the industry and resources that the Northern states have at the time of secession. So the people that built the Hundley, the two that were considered to be the lead engineers are James McClintock and Baxter Watson. James McClintock is known for his skills as an engineer on steamships. So that really ties in when you start looking at the Hundley, because it's almost certainly that it was made out of the repurposed parts from the boiler of a steamship. So if you look at these boilers, there's a little bit of an expansion panel in the Hundley to make it a little bit taller. But aside from that, it's really comparable to a lot of these historic boilers. Some of them are still in existence. So that sort of makes a lot of sense when you think about their shortage of materials, they're under blockade, they can't necessarily get in exactly what they might have wanted to make a bigger submarine.
So among other things, I think this book is a really good example about how science works. Because before you set out to prove your theory of how this happened, you kind of set out to disprove the other theories. And what was involved in some of that?
Well, that's actually, that's a really important thing to do in science, is you have to look at all the reasonable hypotheses and kind of give them a realistic evaluation. One of the biggest traps you can ever get into as a scientist is becoming convinced that your idea is right and that's the only one you're going to pursue. That's really bad. So for the original ones, looking at suffocation, that was largely math. I also work, and I'm actually now proud to be a faculty member at the Duke Hyperbaric Medicine Center. So I do hyperbaric research and thus diving in undersea physiology. Because you're bringing your gas supply with you when you go underwater, that meant that these calculations of gas supply and how long you can live on a certain amount of air are a pretty daily part of my normal job. So that was the first thing that I did when I was looking at the Henle. I had to calculate the gas volume from some pretty improvised methods by measuring everything from photographs because I couldn't get direct dimensions from the ship. But yeah, so that was step one, was looking at the theory of suffocation, calculate gas volume, calculate how long they can live on that. The second one was looking at that lucky shot theory. That was a combination of two things that I personally consider to be really fun, one of which people will disagree with me on because that's archival research. So I spent a lot of time at the National Archives looking at examples from where the Confederacy had cast iron and where they'd shot at cast iron, which actually was surprisingly common because of the ironclads. So they have these beautiful, like, color, hand-painted colorized photos of where they're planning to build the ironclads, and they're shooting at them in various ways. So that let me see kind of what happens during the Civil War and what cast iron is looking like as they're shooting at it in the contemporary time. And then I also did a modern experiment. So I took my undergrad and we befriended a Civil War reenactor, and he was kind enough to bring his rifle. So we shot at cast iron ourselves, which naturally also involved some high-speed videography. So that was a pretty fun experimental time. And we showed that the cast iron breakage patterns on the actual Henle ship in no way matched either what we'd been able to produce at the firing range or what I'd been able to find in the National Archives.
So also, as you get into now trying, moving from disproving or these other theories to trying to prove your own, a lot of the stuff you tried doesn't work, like many, many times. And I thought that was also a good lesson for people who are interested in doing science or anything, really, of all these failures that each teach you a little bit more about how to get to success.
Yes. And I think that's really important. And that was really important to me to write because I've never read a book like that before. I think Hope Yaren in her book, Lab Girl, talks a little bit about what it's like to be a scientist. And she does a great job of doing kind of like a lifelong memoir. But I've never read a book where it talks about what it's actually like to step through a project and how many times it's going to not work before it finally works. I think Edison has a famous quote that I usually refer to, and I forget the exact number of light bulbs he uses, but he says something like, I didn't fail 867 times. I learned 867 times not, or 867 ways how not to make a light bulb. So I think what you have to really think about when you're saying that is that's years of experiments. So he was doing years of experiments before he finally got it to work. And that's a much more realistic account of what being a scientist is like day to day.
When we come back, Rachel Lance talks about the time a car wreck happened right in front of her while she just happened to be driving around with 20 pounds of explosives. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
My colleagues at WFAE have been working hard for months now to keep you informed and enlightened about the coronavirus and what it means for how we're living day to day in these strange times. I'd especially point you towards Charlotte Talks, our daily news show hosted by Mike Collins, which brings in newsmakers and experts from around the country to answer your questions about the coronavirus and to help you make sense of it. For up-to-date and breaking news, go to WFAE.org. For the Charlotte Talks Daily Podcast, go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks or just search for Charlotte Talks in your favorite podcast app. And now, back to Southbound and our conversation with Rachel Lance. Along the way, as you said, kind of referenced a little earlier, you were striving for sort of period accuracy in a lot of this because you wanted to make sure that the best you could, you replicated how things were back then. And this required the acquisition of a lot, sometimes in a weirdly sort of semi-legal way, of black powder. Could you explain why you needed it and why you needed so much of it?
Well, basically, it all goes back to what I was just saying about being a scientist means being comfortable with failure. So when you set up these experiments, you're going to have to fail a few times before you get one right. And so we set off a lot of charges where either the charge wasn't working right, or gauges weren't working right, or just something went awry with the experiment as we gradually iterated toward the solution. And it's very important to me to say we there, because I had a really amazing team of coworkers and, you know, research partners who were with me every single day. And so they deserve a lot of the credit too.
And I guess I should explain really quick, the black powder is what was used in the torpedo that the Hunley used to take down the Housatonic. And that's why you needed it, because you wanted to see how that exploded as opposed to some more modern explosive, right?
Yes, exactly. So C4 is super easy and clean. Black powder is a mess. There's a reason we've moved on from it.
So could you tell the story really quick that you tell in the book about you, and I think your husband, driving back from somewhere with a load of this stuff in your car?
Everyone loves that story. Yeah, it was that was a terrifying moment. I don't want to, you know, don't want to surprise anyone with this, but we basically were looking to get a lot of black powder for these experiments. And so I was working closely with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to make sure that I was doing everything legally and safely. So one of their agents called ahead for me to a black powder vendor and said, like, hey, this person is working with us. She's not a terrorist. Please sell her 20 pounds of black powder. And the reason we picked 20 pounds was because that's the maximum legal limit you can transport in one vehicle. So we wanted to make sure we were following all the rules. So I've got 20 pounds of black powder in the trunk of my car, and I'm on the highway. And of course, there's just this absolutely massive truck tailgating me. It's one of those ones with like the dual rear wheels, and it's been lifted, and it's got the darkened windows, and it's your real, this guy's gonna tailgate me stereotype situation. But then, of course, I'm, as an injury biomechanist, a little bit of a cautious driver, because every injury biomechanist has at some point studied car crashes. So when I drive, I leave a lot of following distance. On the highway, the two cars in front of me just start ricocheting off of each other. And I didn't see exactly what sparked the first one. But before I know it, they're both kind of like ping-ponging off of each other and off of this concrete dividing median between the oncoming traffic. And of course, they're continuing to move forward the whole time because it was so high speed. So they start spinning in circles before they finally come to a stop. Meanwhile, there's this still huge, massive truck in the rear window of my car with his grill basically pressed up against me. And all I can think is that moment is like, oh my God, I've got a 20-pound explosive in my truck.
So you're basically driving a bomb, right?
I was basically driving a bomb. And there's really only one good response in that situation. And so immediately my now husband, at the time we were still just dating, but he sees the exact same thing. He's like, oh my God, behind you. So I'm watching this truck in my rear view as I'm braking, and these cars are in front of me already at a standstill, like just crunched all to hell. And I've already decided, like, if it comes down to it, I am hitting them before I'm letting this guy hit me, because the front end, like that, I mean, that was the decision I had to make, right? The front end of my car at this point in time is much less of an explosive. So it thankfully ended up working out okay. I had left myself enough following distance, but we definitely left some rubber on the highway. And the guy behind me, you could like see his facial expression through the window. He was just looking terrified. And I just wanted to like be able to communicate with him in that moment. This is why you don't tailgate people. But unfortunately, that wasn't possible.
He had no idea just how terrified he should have been, right?
Exactly. He should have been really scared.
So in calmer moments, one of the things I thought was kind of charming about the experiments you did is that you ended up doing most of them in this guy's farm pond. And could you explain, first of all, could you explain why you needed a pond, and then how you convinced this farmer to let you use it?
We needed a pond because private property has a lot less restrictions and regulations. So basically, once you're on private property, as long as you're following the basic rules for explosive safety of the ATF, and as long as you have your proper permits and licenses, then you don't need to do any other real paperwork because it's your own land. So that was what they had.
But also, just to back, but just to back up, you needed a big body of water of some kind because you're blowing stuff up underwater.
Exactly. So we needed a big body of water and we needed it to be on private land. So Duke has several large bodies of water, but I knew even before asking that that was just a non-starter. Like, there was no way they were going to let me do it on campus. So I started looking around, and actually my husband was the one that found it. He's a firefighter with the city of Raleigh. And a lot of the firefighters also are farmers on their off days. So I had him ask around the fire stations for me, which he very thankfully was willing to do. And this one was a family farm and it's owned by a man named Bert Pitt. And his son-in-law works as a firefighter and then helps on the farm on his off days. And thankfully for me, Bert was a big history buff. And so the second he heard about the project, he had a lot more questions and wanted to know what I was exactly planning to do on his land. But that ended up thankfully working out. He was a really understanding guy and he was a really big fan of history. And he was just there asking a bunch of questions and watching us fail a bunch of times. And they were really supportive. His grandkids came out and they helped push the button to trigger the charges a bunch of times as well. So,
and not to spoil anything, I don't think it's a spoiler to say you were convinced after all these experiments that the blast itself is what killed these guys inside the Hunley. And could you explain a little bit why and how the blast could do that without blowing up the ship as well?
Yes. Okay. So explosives, basically, the first thing you have to know is that Hollywood has been lying to you. And it's not super surprising revelation, but a lot of movies, when you see a blast go off, that blast has been created for the visual effect. It's been created for the massive fireball and the big cloud of black smoke, which is actually more a sign that it's a gasoline fire than anything else. But in reality, explosions don't necessarily behave like most people expect them to based on the special effects. And they're different than sound, but sound can be a good way to think of them. So if you are in a hotel room with those cheap thin walls, that sound can travel through. So that's kind of what we were thinking might have happened with the Hunley. And that's why we needed to do the series of experiments where I made a 6.5-foot scale model of the Hunley and blew it up in the farm pond.
And so one of the things that you concluded from all this is not just that the blast trauma killed the men inside, but that they might have not died had the torpedo been positioned differently. Is that right?
That's correct. And I think that's why we've never really seen this kind of case before. This is, I think this phrase is a little overused, but this is your perfect storm explosion. So if they put the torpedo higher in the water, which we know they didn't do on purpose, they probably would have been safe. If they'd been further out of the water, they probably would have been safe. If they'd had their ship made out of different materials, they probably would have been safe. If they'd listened to their explosive advisors in the 1860s and made the spar longer, they probably would have been safe. So this was just a really unique confluence of exactly everything lining up perfectly wrong for these guys.
Did they suffer from this? I mean, was this something that would have kind of killed them instantly, or would they have known what was happening?
With blast, like with a lot of injuries, we tend to avoid giving you a binary, yes, it killed everyone versus no, it didn't kill everyone. Because in reality, what's more realistic is to give a percent chance. So there's a good percent chance that many of them died immediately without ever knowing what happened, without suffering at all. So personally, I think that that's what happened. My charges were pretty underpowered and we still showed a pretty good chance of lethality. there is some chance that, like I said, that first guy, if he was trying to crawl out, he might have just fallen over and fallen that way. If he was trying to crawl out, then that's indicative of blast lung, which is not, it's not a long death. He would have still passed away pretty quickly. So personally, I think that the charge was large enough that they probably wouldn't have suffered. It would have been fairly immediate.
So once you published your findings, all this, I know when that first happened, they got some recognition even before you wrote a book about all this. Did you hear back from the Friends of the Hunley folks, or is your theory now sort of the prevailing theory of what happened here?
I didn't hear back from them directly. They did issue a press release that I didn't think was super appropriate. They hashtagged me fake news. I've yet to hear any actual scientifically grounded rationale of why they disagree. They pretty much just keep saying they disagree. For me, the project is over. I understand that there may always be controversy, but I'm not the type of scientist to ever say, I've 100% correctly factually proved this, because you can't ever say that in science. But for me, this is, I got strong enough data to support my theory and end the project.
And beyond getting kind of getting the historical record straight, is there like a practical value to this research? Is this something that, something you learned that then you can take forward or others can take forward and help us understand things that we're working on now?
Kind of. There's practical value in that people are always looking at the way blasts interact with structures. So the way that the blast moves with structures and it causes injuries to people around the blast, that's always interesting. And I think this is a really unique case study for that. Now, personally, I hope that no submarines are ever this designed this way again, because immediately the next step was to make them thicker and more robust for increased pressure, which also means that you've improved their blast tolerance. So I think that was a really great move for several reasons as the submarine community moved forward. So I don't think this specific scenario will happen, but I do think there's value just generally understanding the way that human beings are injured and killed. 150 years ago feels like a long time, but it's not long enough to change who we are as physical humans. And so their injuries can become our injuries.
You described in the book, and it is sort of in passing a couple of times, about other things that you've studied in your career, you know, working for the Navy and all this sort of thing. You studied, as you, I think you said earlier, breathing apparatuses for divers, studied car crashes and that sort of thing. A lot of like dangerous, risky behavior and that sort of thing. Do you feel like drawn to studying those sorts of events, or do you feel like you're drawn to trying to keep people safe from those sort of things? I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, but does the danger or the risk attract you at all?
Well, I personally am kind of an adrenaline junkie. So I'm a big scuba diver. It's been a while, but I used to like to skydive. You know, I used to commute by motorcycle. So as someone who, I still rock climb a lot, as someone who engages in these types of behaviors, I do kind of have a bigger awareness of my own mortality and the fragility of my body. Like, we're trapped inside this cage of meat and bone. And if it breaks, there's very little we can do about it. So to me, that's a fascinating problem. And I love that my job is to find better ways to keep people safe and to find better ways to keep people healthy and living and intact for longer periods of time. That's what I see as my main goal. But the link between all of those situations is what I kind of see my profession as, is we figure out what happens to people when they go places they shouldn't.
The fate of the H.L. Hunley is a fantastic tale. That's one of several things Rachel Lance proves in her book. But beyond that, I've always thought it was a perfect symbol of the Confederacy. When the Housatonic went down to the Hunley's torpedo, 5 of its crew members died. But of course, the 8 men on the Hunley died as well. And as Lance points out, 13 other men died on the Hunley during its testing. So you might say that the South killed 21 of its own men to take out 5 from the north. That feels about right. The White South, the Confederacy, did so much damage to itself for such damaged reasons that the echoes still carry more than 150 years later. The South is a better place now, more diverse, more vital, far more enlightened. But we have never set things all the way right. And those old sins are always waiting to send us back to the bottom of the sea. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.